Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Jills and Jim's Joyride, the most popular podcast in the kingdom. Is Britain's leading artist. He is named after a Scottish valley and a tin of soup. Ergo, he is Glenn Baxter.
Yes. Welcome, Glenn, to the show.
Pleasure to be here.
Wonderful. I follow him on Instagram as well. You can see a lot of his marvellous artworks on Instagram. A bit like you. You have artworks on Instagram.
Yeah. Well, that's the way forward, yeah.
Yes.
So here we are. How did you get here?
By car, yeah, I drove from our house, yeah.
What is it, a fast car?
It depends who's behind the wheel. It can be fast, or it can be incredibly slow if I want to annoy people.
Are you a keen motorist?
Well, I like driving in the summer in France and Italy and Greece, which is what our trip is usually that, in the summer. But last year we didn't go, obviously, because of the COVID.
Yeah.
But it's the only place where you can actually, in France, you can actually drive on a road and see nothing in front and nothing behind.
Yeah.
Whether that's my driving or not, I don't know. But
the blindfold, maybe.
Yeah.
But so do you drive all the way from London, your home in London, through France and Italy?
Yeah. Well, you can actually cheat because you get on the ferry in Ancona. So you're only going down like half of Italy, really. And there's a 24-hour ferry from Ancona to the Greek mainland, which is what we do. You spend the night on the boat, you get a cabin and everything. It's great.
Have you ever broken down abroad?
We had a funny thing once. We were coming back, and we got all the way back from Greece to Calais, and as we were driving up towards the port, the car started doing this sort of kangaroo thing, and we sort of pulled over, and the guys came out from this garage and, ooh, look at this, and ooh, and terrible, and you know how it is, you know, ooh, yeah. I've seen one of these for many, ooh.
If only it wasn't.
Yeah. So then they towed us into this garage, and there was the spark plugs, which the French for spark plug is bougie, which is a candle.
Oh, nice. Bougie.
Bougie, yeah.
Bougie.
Yeah.
I know, I've learned something there.
There you are. Write it down.
Bougie woogie.
Bougie woogie, yeah.
But some people say, you know, what's the best thing to carry in the event of a breakdown? And all the clever clogs say, or mobile phone. But I think, and you're both artists, visual artists, but I'm not. But I'm an amateur sketchist. And I think a sketchbook is quite a nice thing to have. So when you're sitting on the side of the road, instead of thinking, well, this is all a bit annoying, you can do some nice sort of landscape sketch of your car broken down in on the hard shoulder.
Yeah.
In your drawings, I mean, there's a lot of quite unusual transport takes place. What other sort of transport are you drawn to?
When I was an art student, I was very impressed with the films of Méliès, you know, those rocket to the moon. So anything that's got sort of steel plating, I'm rather drawn to that. Mm. And my dad was actually a welder at the local factory. And I remember he didn't really have much interest in art, but when he came down to see us some years ago, I took him to the War Museum, and he was looking at these paintings by Stanley Spencer of these huge metal cylinders. And he said to me, I said, that's a good painting. I said, why is that? He said, it's got every rivet in place. Which is a good way. It's a good yardstick for appreciating a work of art. If the rivets are in place, this is a work of art.
That's right.
There's some great... If you're looking for pictures of boilers There's some really good ones. At Chatham Dockyard's art gallery, in there, they've got pictures of boilers and Dazzle ships, which I really like.
Oh, they're good, yeah.
Dazzle ships are great. Do you like them?
Thinking about it, I do like an industrial view. And in fact, just seeing an industrial view is quite a treat for me. I quite like that. I mean, are you keen on an industrial views?
Yeah, mostly, yeah. I think anything to escape the drudgery of everyday life is always good.
The are you, Glenn, in your pictures, which have a lot of extraordinary subjects in them, is there things you find challenging to draw ever?
Eyebrows.
Oh.
It's always a tricky one on eyebrow.
Mm.
You have to get it just in the right place.
Well, cause it can...
otherwise, it becomes a moustache.
Yes. Or a frown can be a sort of a smile.
It could, indeed. Yeah,
depending on... I'd never thought that's a challenge.
Do you know those drawings that you used to get and you turn them upside down, so it'd be a bald man, and then you turn around and his beard became his hair? I actually saw a fella who looked like that the other day, and I didn't turn him upside down.
You should have done.
I was thinking, you are the actual living... version of one of those drawings of people that you turn upside down.
And is there an Italian painter, is he even called Gandolfini or something like that, and he draws fruit and it looks like people, but then you turn it upside down and it looks like people as well?
Archimboldo,
that's it.
15th century Italian, yeah.
Yes. Either way up, he looks like sort of fruit.
I wonder if you could do it with anything else.
Hmm.
I'll have to try that out. Have you ever tried doing that?
Being upside down?
Drawing fruit upside down.
No, I haven't got to that desperate stage yet, but who
There's
knows?
There's a lot of cowboys in your work, isn't there?
A lot of cowboys, yeah. Well, that's based on my childhood in Leeds, when it was pretty dangerous to go out, you know.
What, because of the cowboys?
There were too many cowboys out there, yeah.
Where did you first see a cowboy?
I first saw... Well, we used to go to the cinema like three times a week, because they used to change the films over a lot. And every film that you saw, the main feature was always in a Hollywood film in colour. And the B-movie was always cowboys in black and white. And so we were completely immersed in cowboys growing up. And I didn't see a real cowboy till I went to America. And we hired a car in Arizona, and we drove out to this place called Canyon de Chelly, which is kind of an amazing valley with little mud dwellings that the Native Americans had built there. And it was an incredible sort of Ennio Morricone sort of type day, with the wind was, you know, and there was sort of howling. And my wife and I were standing there thinking, shall we go down there and look at this thing? Because it's quite a long way down. And suddenly this figure emerged out of the dust storm, and it was a First Nation Native American.
Oh.
With a hat on and a feather and everything. And, you know, I thought, this is a kind of a childhood dream come true.
Mm.
So he came over and said to us, hello, and... he said, I can take you down there if you like. I said, actually, it's a bit far. Sorry, I said, my name's Glenn. What is your name? Thinking, this is where I'm going to hear this incredible poetic, you know, Navajo name. He held up his hand and said, my name is Clarence. And I thought, why does it always happen to me, you know, that dreams are just shattered right there, you know.
What a great name, Clarence.
Clarence, yeah.
So did you follow Clarence down? Did you go down with Clarence?
No, it was such a long way down, and I thought, I can never get over the shock of, you know, meeting Clarence.
No, that's right.
Did he have a fabulous surname, though?
Frogman Henry, maybe?
Maybe. I was in Arizona once, and there... driving through there, and there was nothing there at all. And then in the distance, I saw a giant Fred Flintstone, about 100 foot high. And it was at a garage. And that's all there was anywhere near. So this huge, great big Fred Flintstone. And outside, they had trestle tables full of great big lumps of plastic, like yellow, transparent plastic. And there was a sign on it saying, jewels dug up from the desert. You can go in and buy them. But they were trying to make out it was amber or gold or something. But
I thought you were going to say it was great big sort of pretend Flintstone steaks.
Well, it could have been. I mean, I tell you what I did in there as well. I bought a packet of biscuits and got them back in the car and opened them up, and they were about 15 years out of date.
Nice. Well, that's Flintstone-ish. Returning to your trip, what year did you go? Was this trip that you went out to the sort of desert with a car and everything?
It would be like 27 years ago, I think, yeah.
I mean, that part of America, I've seen a lot of America, but I haven't really seen that part, the desert.
Yeah, it actually is my wife's birthday present for me. She got us a holiday in this dude ranch in just outside of Tucson, Arizona. And so we went down to all those fantastic cactus places, and we drove up to the Grand Canyon. No Americans go there. In fact, the great thing about the Grand Canyon is when you get there, there's hundreds of Americans in their cars, and none of them are talking. Their jaws are on the floor, so it's absolute silence, which is incredible, because usually they're all, you know, being noisy and brash. So it's absolutely, it's a very quiet moment there. So I enjoyed that.
Did you talk loudly at that point?
Of course I did, yeah. I said, what's wrong with you? Live up to the stereotypes, if you don't mind. We did see a very funny thing on the way to the Monument Valley. When we arrived at Monument Valley, we stayed in the hotel where John Wayne had shot the searchers, you know. And he said, if you go out very early in the morning, you can go down Monument Valley.
Yeah, I like Monument Valley.
I want to come to Monument Valley. No, it's the wrong place. Yes. You know? So they said, before the tourists arrive. So we got in the car, we drove down there. It was all kind of dusty and great. And there was nobody there. We saw this Native American sitting in his Jeep reading the funny papers. And I thought, well, that's good, you know, and he's enjoying himself. As we went past him, his walkie-talkie went off, and he leapt out of his Jeep, and he put on a bandana, and he got onto this Pinto pony, and he rode it up to this crest. At the exact same time, the first Japanese tour bus came round the corner.
Oh, perfect timing.
It was great. So we'd seen, like, backstage of
yes.
all this, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that's what people overlook sometimes, all of the effort that local people put into putting on a great show. I went to Rome when my children were smaller, when they had some friends with us, you know, and we all went there as a gang of children. And around the Colosseum, you could have your photograph taken with a centurion. And so there's a bloke in full centurion's get up standing and waiting, and you sort of go, you had to give him 10 euros or whatever, and you have your picture taken with him. So the children all wanted their picture taken with it. And this particular one, I mean, to be honest, I think if he'd have actually been in the centurion, they would have retired him sometime earlier, because he was getting on a bit to be a centurion. He didn't really have what I describe as, or what I imagined as, the legs of a centurion. They didn't look like the legs of that had sort of kind of created an empire across the Europe, you know, but not sort of legs. And he had these weedy little legs. And then the children said, well, let's have our photograph. We gave them money, let's have a photograph. And then one of them said, hang on a minute, he's smoking a cigarette. The centurions didn't smoke a cigarette, and he told one of them to shut up and push, but and then they pushed it, and then it turned into this huge sort of argument, and it was like, and he was shouting at them and chasing them, and he had the fag hanging out of his mouth, and his
and
centurion's
his
hat
legs.
Came off and his weedy legs. I thought, oh dear, this is just not, you know, let's go.
Are you sure it wasn't
now.
Charles Hawtrey?
It was very, he looked like, that's a very good image, that's exactly what he looked like, curiously enough. But there was a bit of backstage. I remember trying to say to him, I'm in showbiz too, I understand, don't worry, but I couldn't make that clear. You know, we're talking about journeys, and some people it's psychological journeys or emotional journeys, but it sounds like you've gone quite long journeys, and it sounds like the car is your method of choice, really. I mean, you know, especially if you're going across Europe, you must have come across some, that you must have had great adventures doing that.
Yeah, the nice thing about going to Greece in the car is that you kind of come across it very, very slowly. You go through France and you see the various changes in the landscape, and one time I did a mural in this really weird Swiss hotel called the Hotel Furka, which is way above.
How are you spelling that?
F-U-R-K-A.
Yes,
Furka.
Thank you.
Okay. Furka Blick, yes. Yeah, hotel, and it's by the Furka Pass, strangely.
Yes,
and it's where the Rhone Glacier begins its journey down towards the sea. And there's this weird Victorian hotel that this crazy Swiss guy called Mark had developed it, and had artists to come and do sculptures and artworks within this building. So we used to stay there on the way to Greece, and we arrived there, and the next morning we went to the car. It was under like about a foot of snow. So I thought it'd be great to take this to Greece, you know.
Take the snow to Greece.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
yeah.
Probably never seen snow.
But it didn't work because as soon as you get down, it started to melt. So,
oh, that's the thing with snow. And what was the mural that you painted on the wall there? It's quite a thing when you have a mural done.
That's the beauty of being a mural painter. Mm. You lumber someone with your artwork for the rest of their life.
Have you done a lot of murals?
I've done a hotel in Nice. I've done an Egyptian room there. I think I did the ceiling like little stars. And when you open the door to the bathroom, it plays this incredible King of Kings music. So you enter in the vaults.
Oh, how lovely!
It's there still.
It's still there, yeah.
What was the one in the Fokker Hotel?
That was a cowboy looking at a starfish on a wall.
What was the reason? Oh, wasn't there?
Well, the reason was that I thought, well, what's an unlikely event for this to be in this Victorian hotel? And a cowboy looking at a starfish, which is a metaphor for the sheriff's badge, obviously.
Of course.
Yeah, got that immediately. And so I did that there. And various other people, Ian Hamilton Finlay did something outside in the landscape.
Hmm.
But it's now... not there anymore. I mean, it is there, but it's not in an art hotel as it was.
A shame. But have you done any murals, Jim?
I did one in Deptford.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, and I can't remember what... I'm going to just erase all that because I can't remember what it was I did. I did it in a school and I've no idea what it was that I did. I was teaching some little kids painting and we did a big mural and I can't remember what it was. Probably some scenes from Deptford.
Hmm, how lovely. So how about shipping? Do you have a way you stand on shipping and railways?
It's a bad combination, isn't it, really? Unless you have an underwater railway.
That would be, now you're talking.
That's a possibility, yeah.
Yeah. No.
Now we're into the realms of Jules Verne and George Méliès now, aren't we?
Exactly, yeah.
Underwater trains. Oh, this is a bit sad, this, but I'm going to tell you anyway. My granddad, he was in the First World War and he went over to France. And what they did was they got to Folkestone and they got off the train and got on a boat and went off to fight in France. And there was no boats coming back that way because they brought them all back, the dead bodies, into Dover.
Oh.
So you didn't see them coming back in.
Oh.
But he was there, and it's quite a thing, really, when you stood there thinking, my granddad was here and he was probably 16.
Mm.
And what an awful thing to have to, you know, get off a train and onto a boat and... He his job was to take messages through the lines. So he said he was on a push bike and he said he'd see like shells going over both ways over the top of him and there'd be explosions on either side. Anyway, trains and boats.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And what about your journey through as an artist? People love your work. In Holland, they're particularly keen on your work, aren't they, as well, I believe? I mean, not just this Holland, but the Dutch quite like your... are drawn to your works, is that right?
They're drawn to my works, yeah. Mostly because a Dutch publisher called Jaco Groot, he came to London and he was in a really rather boring publisher's meeting. And at the back of the room, they had these copies of this magazine called The London Magazine, magazine of literature and poetry. And occasionally at Glenn Baxter, and he saw my work in there and he thought, oh, this is interesting. So he went to there's a gallery in Covent Garden called Hester van Rooyen, which is now a sort of fashion shop, but because it was a Dutch name, he went in to see the gallery owner and she said to him, oh, are you interested in any English artists? And he said, yes, I'm interested in Glenn Baxter. And she said, well, funnily enough, he's got an exhibition next door starting in a month's time at the Anthony Stokes Gallery. So he came over for that and I met him and he said to me, who's your English publisher? I said, well, I haven't got one. So he said, well, would you like to come to Holland and be published? So I immediately agreed. So I went off to Holland with a suitcase full of drawings. It became my first book, Atlas. And he went round telling everybody he discovered this great genius, Glenn Baxter, and he's going to publish his book. And then he printed, I think, 2,000 copies of this book and sent them all out across Holland. And the bookshops took six in the whole of Holland. And so he said, well, it's a start, Glenn. And we're still friends, despite all that, many, many years later. And I've got a book coming out with him, actually, in October. So
In the Netherlands?
In the Netherlands only, yeah.
Yes, no, that's good. But and when you first went to the Netherlands, how did it first strike you when you first went there?
Well, the first time we got off the plane in Holland, you know, the flat countries, the first sign you see is a sign saying, mind the step. I thought that was an interesting observation, for people arriving there. And just amazing that everyone spoke English there. You know, I tried to speak a bit of gibberish, but Nipo just weren't having it. The people were very welcoming too. You know, they realised what a pathetic lives we English were leading. They took pity on us, you know, and gave us a Heineken and a herring and said, right, now enjoy yourself.
And of course, the Dutch have a huge history of being painted. I don't know, I never quite understood why that was, but they're just huge in the 17th century. More people had art than at any time sort of in the history of ever.
It's because of the herring diet, Jules.
Was it?
That's what it is, yeah.
Very good for your eyes.
Yeah. There's this funny thing about Scheveningen, which is by the sea. And you go to The Hague, which is the capital, and there's an incredible beach there. We took our little son, Harry, there years ago. And then we brought him back to The Hague. And there's a museum there called the Panorama Mesdag, which you go inside and it's a domed interior. And he's painted a 360-degree mural of Scheveningen. And they've very cunningly built sand up to the edge of the central platform.
So it's a bit like being on a bandstand, isn't it? Actually?
Yeah, exactly. Yes. And it gives an incredible sort of trompe-l'oeil, vision of it. And our son Harry was about six at the time, and he said, "Dad," he said, "but we've just been here, but the first one was outdoors." That's brilliant observation.
Yeah, right. And it is a great. I went there recently, actually, to that place in. Den Haag, as we call it. Interesting Holland. Close, but absolutely different.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Do you get up and work in the morning?
Yeah, I like to work in the morning till lunchtime. Then
yeah.
I used to go for a swim, which I still do now. We can go back, have a swim. Come back, lunch, siesta, being a fully-fledged European, and then work again until about 7 o'clock, then a drink, dinner, and then collapse, basically.
Yeah, I like working in the morning. Mm. I was working at 5:30 this morning, and that's the best time for me, early in the morning. And I used to go for a swim. I should start doing that again. I'd work, go for a swim, come back and do some more work, lunch, and then go for a walk. Nice life, isn't it?
Nice life. Because, of course, George Simenon, the writer of Maigret, his writing routine was similar to both of you as visual artists, although he was writing. But he would get up very early and start writing, and he'd stop for coffee at 11, and then he would carry on writing. Then he'd have a light lunch. Then he would have to, according to my mother, who never met him, he would have to find somebody for the purposes of sex. and it was often a different person every day, but people who were obviously agreeable to it, you know. And then he'd have a little rest, and then sort of carry on writing for the rest of the afternoon.
And where was this? Let me picture it. Where was it?
Well, I'm not quite sure. I mean, I think he came from Liège originally, but probably, and then he was in Paris, you know. So I suppose it's a bit more convenient in Paris for that sort of thing. But yeah.
But what did he do when he went on holiday to Bridlington?
Good question. I think that was a great inspiration when Maigret goes to Bridlington.
Whilst we're talking about Liège...
Yes.
Can I just add a little story about Liège?
Yes.
Okay. I had an exhibition there run by this crazy Arabic guy called Antaki. And it was a tiny little gallery. And he invited us over there, and there were lots of drinking beers and stuff at the vernissage, and we stayed late, and about 1 o'clock in the morning, he was driving us back to his house through the entire deserted streets of Liège, and the only place that was open at 1 o'clock in the morning was the funeral parlour.
No.
Lights were full on, and they had three caskets in the window, and I thought, well, people say that Belgium is the birthplace of surrealism. This is living evidence of that, exactly the same thing, you know.
Wow, that is, and you could see where Magritte, who I think came from Liège, actually, didn't he?
Magritte came from somewhere near there, yeah. And it just proves that Magritte is a social realist.
Yes.
You don't have to make things up, because in Belgium they already exist.
We did a show when our last European tour was on, just outside of Liège. We drove on the motorway just outside of Liège, and the thing I write, we came past, which was what we were talking about earlier, a huge petrochemical, I think it was a huge chemical works by the side of the motorway, and it went on and on, like, it was like enormous, this plant of like, you know, pipes coming up, and it was quite surreal, and because it was so much of it, and it was vast pipes and chimneys and sort of ducts and things that you couldn't work out quite what they did, and big buildings with sort of vents coming out of them. It just went on and on and on and on. And then we got to the bit of the end, and it had a sign to what the place was called. And it was a place of a city. And it had such a great name because it was spelt with a CH. It was called Chemolot.
Really? Was that its real name?
Chemolot. Exactly. Chemolot. Well, it just was, yeah. Chemolot. And there was a lot of it, and it was Chemolot.
I love those places. What's it? Merthyr Tydfil, is that one? That's got a lot of...
Swansea, isn't it?
Yeah. That's just like a huge amount of... Yeah. That and Peter Lee, which I love, because you go through Peter Lee and it's just one great big ICI works, and they've got pipes that go over the top of the road. So you're like driving through a tunnel of pipes.
Yes. Lovely.
Enchanting, yes. Isn't it?
No, I do. It's the sort of thing I go and sketch for my holidays. Yeah.
I think it's because I'm equally attracted to magnificent natural beauty as I am to filthy...
Industrial decay?
Yeah. I remember going through the desert from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and the driver was trying to avert my eyes from a big, huge petrochemical plant, like I shouldn't see it. He's going, look over here, look at the beautiful desert. And I was going, but I like that over there. He was going, no, don't look at that, look over here.
Actually, that's brought something into my mind. Shit, that's why it's gone again. So it was there for a second.
It was a brief second.
Now, when you said something, you were talking about the... And now, a message from our sponsors.
Jules, these new piano-playing gloves are truly miraculous.
Yes, sir. That's because they have 17 fingers on each hand.
Thank you. Now I can play like Mrs. Mills, Richard Clayderman and Bobby Crush combined.
The 17-fingered piano glove by Peak Free and Biscuits. Very good.
What was your first car?
We had a black Morris Minor.
Yeah, you can't go wrong with that.
No.
Was that yours or your parents'?
No, it was my wife's car, yeah.
Yeah.
But did you drive all across Europe in this Morris Minor?
No, we didn't. We drove across Europe in a Peugeot, then latterly a Volkswagen.
How far did you go in a Morris Minor?
We went camping in France once with my wife's three kids. We stayed in a place called La Falaise, which I discovered later meant the Windy Bluff. And there's an incredible rainstorm that night. And it just poured and poured and poured. And the wife and three kids slept in the Morris 1000. And the next morning they came in to find me alone in this tent, in a sleeping bag on a pump-up mattress, the Lilo thing. And there's a radio on a floating cushion next to my head, and it was playing Victor Sylvester.
Oh, how lovely.
And when we came back home to England, I remember walking around our apartment and sort of kissing the concrete walls, saying, I appreciate you now.
Exactly. Simple thing like that, being stuck in the rain, can make you appreciate what four walls and a roof can be.
Exactly, yeah.
What about getting a big hotel room and putting a tent in it?
A hotel room?
Yeah, and then put a great big hotel room, big enough to put a tent in, and then putting the tent in if you wanted to. I tell you what, Björk, the singer, she told me, I did ask her what she took to her, if she took anything on tour, and she said she always took a Primus stove, and in her room, they would have a little sort of cook-up around the Primus stove in the hotel room.
That's a nice idea, isn't it? Mm.
What about the hotel sprinkling system? Doesn't that come into play when...
Well, I think maybe they quite like that because it made it all the more like you were sort of outdoors.
It's raining.
Yes, it's raining.
And I'm cooking.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm home.
Yeah, exactly. It was great. They loved that best.
Have you ever driven through Iceland?
Not recently, no.
Have you?
I did once, actually, yeah.
So now that's an experience.
Yeah.
I got in, hired a car and I got some dried fish and left them in overnight. That's a big mistake. Because you get in the next day and there's an overpowering stench of old fish, and drove through incredible snowstorms, and then I got stuck in a snowdrift. And the Icelandic people are really nice, but they've got a strange way about them. They saw that we'd got stuck in this snowdrift and they stopped to help us, but all they did was just look at us, waiting for us to say, "Can you help?" It was polite of them.
But I have a... You're right, very helpful. I had this experience. I was driving across Iceland on a little trip, and I was with Jennifer Saunders and Aid Edmondson. They'd all organised it. And we rented a car, and then and on the cassette on the car, a CD, it tells you where to go, and then it stops, and you press the next bit. And you walk, you go through what I would describe as a sort of a Tolkien type of landscape of incredible... So the odd, very distant sort of monastery on a hill, and then for miles of nothing. Anyway, we were driving along this road, and we'd been driving for like an hour, not seen anything at all. And there's a long, straight bit of road, and the distance is a speck. And as we get closer, we see that it's a broken down vehicle, and it's a man standing next to a Volkswagen camper van that had a puncture.
That was me.
Was it?
You were the people who were staring at me.
Anyway, maybe where it was, but. We got along, and this man was like, he had a puncture, was many. So we got along, we slowed down, and he looked up, and he had, because it was freezing cold, if you got out of the vehicle for a moment, we'd gone to see the Northern Lights, so it's very cold at that time of year. Got out of the vehicle for a moment, your teeth hurt if you smiled, that's how cold it is. So anyway, he was outside trying to fix his wheel, and he had a fur-lined sort of hood, and he looked up, and his face was, he must have been, I'm guessing, maybe 65 or 70. He had a very white, red face, and a white beard, and no moustache. Do you know that sort of look?
Yeah.
And bulging blue eyes and white eyebrows. And we said to him, "Excuse me, do you need any help at all here? Can we help you?" And he just looked at us as if we'd stopped and asked him to clean our car. And he went, "No!" I said, "Oh, all right then." And off we went. I'm only trying to help you, mate. Don't get out your pram. But that was, yeah.
Well, it's the Icelandic way, obviously.
It's the Icelandic way.
Should have offered him a moustache to go with his beard.
Exactly.
That would have been the way forward in that Icelandic etiquette, wouldn't
I think
it?
You're right. In fact, if you don't want us to help with your puncture, what about a moustache?
Have you ever seen the Northern Lights?
No, I haven't.
That's a thing. I thought that was in Iceland as well. And I was looking for them every night and went to speak to someone in the hotel and said, "We've been hoping to see the Northern Lights." And they said, "Oh, 11:15, we've been going to bed early because it gets dark at 3 o'clock." And so at 11:15, stayed up and looked out the window, and there they were at 11:15, like it was a Pink Floyd light show that they'd just turned on.
Or maybe they had.
Maybe that was
it. You can see the wires.
Yeah, exactly.
Bit of a giveaway. Yeah.
No, they are. I did see them once. I'd say that was an incredible thing. I've never seen anything like it. You couldn't even describe them, and you couldn't photograph them.
No, and you don't want to. It's just one of those things you've got to look at, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being our guest today, Glenn Baxter. I'm a great admirer of your artwork and your personage, and it's marvellous to hear some of your transportation stories that we've enjoyed very much today. Glenn Baxter, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, there goes Glenn, travelling home in his black Morris Minor.
With the indicator stuck out, the semaphore indicator stuck out.
With his winker sticking out of the window.
Marvellous. Bye, Glenn.
This podcast was produced and edited by Molly Stewart.
Sound engineers were James Stewart and George Latham.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.